This is side two. When we when the tape ended, we were talking about the generations that the cyclotron has gone through. And the first one you mentioned was the K-50.
Yes. So that's the cyclotron that came into operation in 1966. Ran here until something like 1979, and had the most precise beams of any cyclotron before or since. And it was just exploited by a skillful group of nuclear physics people to do significant important measurements of nuclear properties. And we also built a theoretical physics group. Hugh McManus came from England to Chalk River to MSU. Yeah, those were the K-50 years. A copy of the K-50 still exists in Princeton and is lightly used. Mm-hmm. You know, not a big star of the physics world, but still hangs in there. Let's see, someplace in the early 1970s, we got interested in the possibility of superconducting coils for cyclotrons. For me, that happened when I was visiting Princeton and given a couple of weeks of lectures on cyclotrons to the physics group there. And one of the old professors walked into the office I was occupying and asked, what do you think would happen if we put a superconducting coil on our cyclotron here? I had often gave an important paper saying superconductivity didn't look like it would help cyclotrons much. So that paper has sometimes, or that sentence.
Come back to haunt you?
Come back for a chuckle. one of my best friends made a slide of it and showed it at one of the international conferences. At that moment, I was there was the time to do some thoughtful thinking. And came tearing back from Princeton, getting Dave Johnson to start calculations, mm-hmm. and canceling a trip to South Africa, which I was going to give some lectures down there. Just really went to work. And after about a year, we had money to build a prototype magnet. Wrote a proposal to the National Science Foundation. So that magnet had lots of political overtones.
What were those?
Well, let's see, we had a few years earlier proposed a big new cyclotron here, which had just gotten stomped on in the review process. Everybody wanted the next, all of these 10 or 15 important nuclear physics laboratories all wanted to grab the next important machine. Mm-hmm. Everybody stomped on everybody else's proposals. Nothing got approved. Mm. So I decided that the key to getting something new was to propose it as a development project with the final site for the cyclotron undetermined. That was to be fixed later, and everybody was to have a chance at it.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a big group of people to sign the proposal as sponsors. Mm-hmm. And got around this tendency to factionalize.
Mm-hmm. Get the reviewers to look at the science versus the political location.
Yeah, right. And then once the magnet is built, of course, the option of not doing anything with it has pretty much disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it will go somewhere rather than nowhere. And I think we were here all willing to have it go somewhere else. University of Rochester came out as the leading alternate site. And one of the pitches that we made was to say, MSU made, was to say that we would provide positions for the entire Rochester faculty if the site was awarded here.
Mm-hmm.
And would they make the same proposal if the cyclotron went there? And their administration wouldn't do that.
Uh-huh.
And so in the end, none of the Rochester faculty did come here.
Oh, really? But at least it was there on the table.
Yeah, that was on the table.
Hmm. Interesting.
And, so,
whose idea was that in terms of the planning?
I think it was mine.
Oh, yours.
Yeah, it was mine.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, yeah. So then, let's see. The magnet we got money to build it with in 75. It came into operation in 77. And in 78, MSU was approved as the site for making it into a cyclotron.
How President Wharton, was he supportive during that time? Or?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we've just had the strong support of the administration right on through.
Mm-hmm.
From Hanna through each president.
And so when did that cyclotron become operational?
I'm slightly fuzzy there, but I'll say 83. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
were there any major problems you encountered in construction of that, or either in design or?
Let's see. So there were some pretty glum days, like one day in the early testing of the magnet, there was something akin to a fire.
Oh.
The fire trucks were called and came to the building. What was going on is a certain electrical failure had developed, which caused big lightning-like bolts to fire off in different directions.
Were you in the building at the time?
Yes, standing there watching it.
Oh, no.
And people would run up with carbon dioxide extinguishers and make an arc go out,
mm-hmm.
but then it would just strike someplace else.
Mm.
After the fact, we all understood why that was so.
Mm.
And that, you know, typically you'd end up with holes in the 6-inch diameter category melted into the equipment.
Wow.
Where the bolt of lightning was landing.
Wow.
And so, walking home the evening after the smoke had died down, that was very glum, mm-hmm. you know. Not yet having an assessment
mm-hmm.
of how much damage there was.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the coil itself was not damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And so in maybe 6 months, we were back testing again and understood why the previous test had gotten in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, but, right, there were some glum days.
The, at what point was there a proposal to use it for medical research, or not just research, but cancer treatment especially?
Yeah, well.
How did that come about?
That came about, let's see, like when that, let's see, this cyclotron I've just been talking about is one we call the K500.
K500.
Yeah, so 10 times the energy of the first cyclotron, but about the same size because the superconducting coils let much smaller cyclotrons be built. Anyway, there was a press conference, and a doctor in Detroit, William Powers, heard me on one of the Detroit TV stations or in the Free Press. Let's see, I'm a little confused. I think maybe he just read it in the Free Press, that superconductivity allowed us to build smaller, lighter, and less expensive cyclotrons.
Mm-hmm.
And a very bold guy, he just picked up the telephone and called me and said, I need one of those.
If you're going to pull one off the shelf.
Yeah. Anyway, we were already working on the K1200, mm-hmm. which is the third generation cyclotron. But we started doing the medical project in parallel with that.
And so that was a separate machine?
Yeah.
It wasn't really portable, was it? Or it was just could be done in another location?
Oh, it's portable in the sense that we built it and tested it here and mm-hmm. put it on a truck and hauled it to Detroit.
I see.
And put it in the building. This is a model of it.
Oh.
Over there. So the patient is full scale relative to the same scale as the cyclotron.
Uh-huh.
There.
Is that still operational?
Yes, it's at its most successful phase.
Hmm.
So doing a world-leading job on advanced prostate cancer.
Hmm.
Okay. And and that's a big population.
Half the population.
Yeah. I did slip in the word advanced there.
Mm-hmm.
So, that, most prostate cancer, if it's detected early,
mm-hmm.
Can be treated with more routine mm-hmm. techniques. But
these are used in extreme cases.
Yeah, mm-hmm. if it's metastasized into the abdominal cavity, but not elsewhere in the body,
mm-hmm.
That's what this particular category C.
Mm-hmm.
Advanced is used to describe,
mm-hmm.
and it's that stage where the neutron beam, which this cyclotron produces, is just been exceptionally effective.
Mm-hmm. Were these results, were you involved in the publishing in any medical journals as a result of that?
Or? Oh yeah, I've got a lot of, I didn't write any of those articles, but the Detroit people put my name on them as well, because it's certainly a joint effort.
Mm-hmm.
The results could not have been accomplished without the total group.
Mm-hmm. So the K1200 is the current generation, or
yes,
okay,
that's our present. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the highest energy cyclotron in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Highest energy. Accelerator in many respects.
Mm-hmm. Were there any fears that you had heard expressed around in the university community about the cyclotron and what was happening when you flipped the switch or anything like that? Were there any of those things that you had heard or were aware of?
Oh, yeah, we had our phase of students demonstrating here. Let's see, for a while on the K50, we had a research grant from the Office of Naval Research.
Mm-hmm. In the 60s, that would have been?
Yes, it probably overlapped into the 70s. Mm-hmm. Like around 1970 would be
years.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of our graduate students was a leader of this group, and so he liked to lead them over here because it made him look more important, I think. Richard Trilling, that's a name I remember. And he's, when I last knew of Richard, he was worked for IBM in their computer design.
Didn't lead too many demonstrations over there.
Didn't lead too many, wore a coat and tie. Yes, a changed individual. But, right, so that was a worry. And then there was a stage where there were some concerns that the heavy ion collisions could turn into a chain reaction that would burn the atmosphere, wipe out the planet.
Oh. How did you deal with that?
This was aimed at a number of facilities around the world, which included ours. So it wasn't only aimed at us. But anyway, high-level people in the theoretical physics community made estimates of how this might happen. The same issue had come up when the first atomic bomb was detonated. And so this was a similar fear, except with a different trigger, different trigger mechanism. And so it turned out to be an unfounded fear. And yeah, we had no delays because of that.
How long were you the director here? Or in other words, when did you retire?
Let's see, I would need to get my resume out to be accurate about that, but I retired once in 1967, and Aaron Galansky was director for something like 3 years. Somewhere like 86 or 87, we changed to a co-director system, where Sam Austin and I were co-directors of the laboratory. After the co-director thing had lasted 5 years, Sam became the director. And he was director for 5 years, and then Conrad Gielpke has been director about 8 years. So if you work back from that, it would be maybe 88 or something when I stopped being a co-director.
Are there any areas of research that you're working on right now?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Better cyclotrons.
Yeah, better cyclotrons.
Yes. Particularly right now, I'm working on another medical project. Let's see, like the Detroit machine uses a neutron beam to kill the cancers. And the neutron beam can't be pointed very accurately. The particles are neutral, and so magnets can't change their direction. An alternate thing which requires a bigger cyclotron, a bigger, more expensive cyclotron, is to use protons as the projectiles. And one such facility has been built in a hospital. A number of physics lab machines have been used for proton therapy, as it's called. And at Loma Linda University, they have a $50 million facility for doing proton therapy in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So if something is in a physics lab, it's really not accessible to very sick people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They need the life support stuff that a hospital has. Mm-hmm. And so all the medical committees immediately said it's pointless to be putting money into medical facilities in physics labs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Get them in the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one at Loma Linda has been running for 2 or 3 years. And there's one in Boston, which we've helped a lot with, which is built by a company from Belgium.
Mm.
And they're ready to run.
Mm-hmm.
Right now they're saying they expect to treat the first patient next January.
Mm.
And then the one I'm working on today, as soon as you leave, is one which a Swiss laboratory wants to purchase from a German company.
Mm-hmm.
Using a design that we did in 1993,
mm-hmm.
a superconducting proton therapy cyclotron.
Are there any other areas that you see in the future besides medical research?
The laboratory is changing its direction in a major way right now,
mm-hmm.
From cyclotrons to linear accelerators.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, I've never worked on linear accelerators. And, I'm 72, mm-hmm. So if I shifted to linear accelerators, I think it would take me 5 years to get to a place where I would make much of a contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm tending to stick to cyclotrons and give the boys who are marching toward Linux a pat on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Not really pitching in to help that effort.
In reflecting back on your mm-hmm. career here at Michigan State, anything that stands out maybe as just most important that you come to mind?
Most important? Gosh, I don't know.
I know that's a tough question, but...
Yeah. the support from the administration was certainly a key factor. The lab gradually moved from being an internal group in the physics department to being a department-level unit in the College of Natural Science to now being a college-level unit in the university. All of that was driven by me realizing that I had much higher probability of getting a request approved as soon as it got to the top administration.
Yeah.
So
without the filters in between.
Yeah, trying to get the physics department to vote in favor of something was and is an enormously burdensome process.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big improvement to just move into a separate department in the college.
Mm-hmm.
But still, in the early years of what we called our phase two effort, the Department of Energy was managing the funding. And needed decisions from people who could sign contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lee Winder just said, sure, we'll make this a department, a college-level entity under me.
Mm-hmm. That simplified the process.
Yeah, that simplified the process.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you for the time that you've given me.
Uh-huh.
And on behalf of the project, thank you.
Ah, indeed. So, good luck.